Well, I won't say too many personal remarks now, save them for dinner, but I think as many here, I think this is a very bittersweet feeling. I think Elisa used those words, and but as the conference goes on, I feel it's more sweet than bitter. And I just wanted to thank Philippe, Hélène, and John for putting this together. This is work we were presenting, early work versions with Emmanuel, and had rebaptized the name towards Taming a Minsky Skalisko. Let me put it in context. So it's part of an agenda macroprudential policy, and this is a figure I use to think about macroprudential policy. Macroprudential policy is the idea that financial decisions we make today may have an impact later on when we get hit with a shock, maybe a recessionary shock. And for example, the amount of borrowing may affect later on how deep the recession is due to the deleveraging. And so then the natural next question is, if that's so, should we regulate those decisions because they have an impact later on? And the obvious answer is not necessarily. We need to isolate an externality. Many things have an impact in the future based on decisions today. So we need to figure out what the market failure is. So that's something we need to answer. We need to build a framework for. Another question is, why don't we just fix things ex post when they happen with monetary or fiscal policy, right? So we want a framework that can address that question as well. And perhaps the next question is, and this is a part of a policy debate, is should we also, in those initial periods before hitting a crisis, think of monetary policy as another tool to lean against the wind? So in a series of papers, I think Emmanuel and I have been developing this kind of framework for thinking about these issues broadly and in a bunch of applications. And what we focus on is really that in that second phase, the economy is hurting, Main Street is hurting, okay? And we think the most relevant form that takes is a recession of a Keynesian sort. And although the model we built is very general and can deal with pecuniary externalities, our focus has been on bringing aggregate demand to externalities to the forefront. And we've done a bunch of applications, so this is kind of to tell you where this is coming and where we're going next. And I may review the basics of the general framework we had earlier. But what's new today and what I want to talk about is this idea of Minsky boom cycles. It's also related to Kindleberger's manias and panics. And the idea, Minsky was sort of a post-Keynesian that was thinking that both Friedman and Keynes, let's say, made it look too easy. The truth is, it's not going to be so easy to stabilize because the importance of the financial cycle, that there will be a boom period where there's complacency and risk-taking and borrowing, followed by a certain realization that we've gone too far and risk repricing, deleveraging that will create a bust. And as I'll show you some quotes, he calls for things, for thinking then hence about financial regulation and things. So I think he was ahead of the time in that sense. We have monetary policy, we have fiscal policy, and macroprudential policy is kind of a backwater, a third rail. And part of the work we've been doing is trying to provide foundations to change that, right? So the new thing is we want to capture something like that. And in particular, we're going to do that with the kind of non-rational expectations, a departure from rational expectations that is popular in some circles of finance due to Greenwood Schleifer and other and co-authors. In particular, there's a nice book by Nicola Genaioli and Schleifer and Andre out now that discusses that. Let me skip this. So, for those who don't know what that is, this is a figure from one of their famous papers that just shows the expectations investors have of future returns and how well it correlates with the past returns. Okay. So this is just a correlation, but I think when correlations are this striking, and they dig a lot more deeply, you know, it does give pause to a sort of our baseline rational expectation model. So we're diving into that, if you like, wilderness of non-rational expectations, because we take seriously this kind of evidence. And we think if we take seriously this kind of evidence, it also has normative implications. All right. So Minsky, to say, you know, to tell you the truth, this paper was not born by reading Minsky and then thinking, let's formalize it. Instead, we were coming at it maybe through these extrapolative expectations, then realized that many of the messages were in more narrative form in this work by Minsky. I already said some of these things. And basically, let me show you instead some quotes that I think are interesting, and that these kind of ideas will be elements in our model. So, you know, he was thinking of this boom and bust and the importance of middlemen in finance affecting that, and the idea that, you know, past returns matter and make you optimistic, and so much so that a rise in an asset price might increase the demand for the asset. And then, but calling for a theory, okay, that will incorporate these ideas, and I think also suggesting the need for thinking about institutions and financial regulation. So that's how we read into what he said, is somewhat in line with the kind of ideas we have here. I'll skip that. So I'm gonna do something maybe unusual, which is show you this general framework we developed to give some context. I'll show you the very quickly in two or three slides the main elements of that, and then jump into the new elements that we're gonna bring in. So the new elements is a departure from rational expectations of the sort I mentioned. First, let me do something also unusual, show a picture of Emmanuel, because I have a special picture, which is when we started working on this paper. So there we were in a conference, and you know, we were talking about this idea, and he just started, you know, plugging away and deriving things during the conference, not necessarily paying attention to the, and I had to take a picture, and I'm glad I did. So there are many good pictures of Emmanuel, but it's nice to see one in action, and it's exactly developing this paper. So this is an earlier paper, I said, and it's just to provide a little context, and then very quickly develop the main thing we had. So it's a very general model with many agents. To talk about finance, you need many agents that are trading, and any number of goods. And it's important to distinguish goods in spot markets versus financial markets. So for that, we have this general notation here. But the important thing is S is a state of the world or time. Okay, and J is a commodity. So in the typical application, there'll be two commodities, you know, consumption and labor. Okay, and then different states of the world or time. All right, that's almost it. I'll show you very quickly. The model fits on one slide, so there's just very general preferences that agents have. There could be heterogeneity across agents, so that's the I there. General technology, and then this is important. We write this down in a simple way, sort of a two-step budget constraint. So starting with the second one here, this budget constraint is the spot market. So you're buying these goods, J, in the spot market, and you've come in with some wealth, with it, which is an Arrow de Brou asset, okay? And maybe you're being taxed. But this is one budget constraint per state of the world. And assuming complete markets, which is just for simplicity here, in the first stage, you are in the financial market and you're making those choices of how much assets to have in each, for each state of the world. So together, these describe the budget constraints. Okay? So it's these choices of financial decisions in this market that we want to think of how we want to distort or how we want to intervene so as to make the spot market do better. Okay? That's the one way to think about it, that distinction. So this is a macroprudential tax. This tau here would be zero if we're not intervening, and we're going to put in non-zero taus to intervene in financial decisions. Okay. We also can incorporate borrowing constraints of a general form by imposing constraints on these choices X, more generally. Okay. But I'm being a little bit it's a bit of a flyover here, but you'll see that I think it, and then we have a very general form of nominal rigidities, a pretty general form of nominal rigidities, all right? So that, those are the elements of the model. And our main result was as follows. If we define, sorry, yes, go ahead.
Could you just name the, sorry to be
serious. No, please ask. This and this?
Yeah, what are they?
Yeah, so this is the, start with this one. This is the budget constraint once the state of the world S is realized. So there's one for each state of the world. And you're buying these goods in the spot market. Indeed, if you're you're selling your labor, so one of these is negative. Okay, so this is very, you know, basic micro, Mascalel type notation, okay? In a prior period, you took some financial decisions that affected how much wealth you had in that period, okay? And this is assuming complete markets. Actually, we extend it to incomplete markets. But just to actually emphasize that even when markets are complete and perfect, we may want to intervene them. Okay, so we think that sort of the more surprising cases when financial markets don't have imperfections, we still want to intervene in them. Okay. Thank you. So yeah, and this is that arrow de Brou security. So Q is the price of the arrow de Brou asset, and D is the quantity you choose. But you're getting taxed according to this. Okay. Okay, so.
Sorry,
yeah.
So oops. The B, which are the budget, the borrowing constraints, I think you said?
Yeah.
These, can they depend on the prices or not?
Yes, in this basic model, no, but in an extension we show, and that's how we get pecuniary externalities. So that's an excellent question. Yeah, that's in the paper, but I'm giving you the basic model. But the one that highlighted more, I think, which was our innovation, which was to bring aggregate demand externalities a little more to the forefront, okay? So now we do something which is defined a wedge, which is just a number that would be zero if spot markets work perfectly, okay? So this in typical applications, it's what we call the labor wedge. Macroeconomists call the labor wedge. So it's just the difference between the marginal rate of transformation and the marginal rate of substitution, okay? It's just here we have potentially more goods, so there are many wedges. Okay, so first best would have all these wedges equal to zero. And our main result was this very simple formula, okay, that, you know, we liked its simplicity and its power, and also because it spoke, I think, very intuitively. And it's saying the tax we want on a financial asset imposed on a certain agent is equal to this right-hand side. So this is the tax, this is what we're trying to find out, and this is what it should be set equal to, okay? And what it is a combination of these wedges, okay? And so immediately you see that if the wedges were all zero, we had the first best in spot markets, then we would not want to intervene in financial markets, okay? And so the idea is this is a second best problem, that if we do have a problem in spot markets, then we might want to intervene in, and this is telling us how to handle that second best problem optimally, okay? And the formula basically is simply a weighted, a sum across these different wedges, but multiplied by the marginal propensity to consume. So this X subscript I, the I is income, so this is the marginal propensity to consume in that state of the world for that good. And the intuition then for this formula is very basic. It's if you are a person who spends a lot in a certain state of the world on a good that is being underprovided, for which the wedge is positive, then we should want you to have a lot of wealth there, okay? Because that's going to ease that that wedge that we have in that market, okay? So that's the basic intuition, and you can call that a Keynesian intuition if you like. So basically, if there's some state where we're depressed and we have a recession, then we would want the people who spend a lot on, in that state of the world to have more wealth there. And for example, hence, we might want people not to borrow too much and end up having too much debt and try to deleverage that debt in those states of the world. Okay, but this general formula kind of transcends the environment I gave you, and that's kind of, you know, where we're coming from. And I hope you'll see aspects of it in what follows next. But next, I'm jumping into the innovation, which doesn't fit this formula. And so many things do fit this formula. I think others have found it useful as well, but. What we're doing now is a departure from rational expectation that is going to require us to think beyond that, okay? So what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk, and I'm mindful of the time, is fill out this box, okay? So starting with rational expectations as a baseline, which will be a special case of what I just did, I'm going to show you a model with financial intermediation and extrapolative expectations that that I'm going to explore both with under rational expectations and these forms of extrapolative expectations. And I'm going to show you that if we just have access to monetary policy under rational expectations, we should just do the same standard inflation targeting, even though we do have an additional friction here. Okay? Or at least in a baseline case, we don't want to depart from the basic principles of monetary, optimal monetary policy. But when we have access to macro Prue, we do in general want to use it. Okay? This line is going to be interesting, but not. We're going to be exploring a new environment for which the old theory would have applied. And then we'll do extrapolative expectations and show you that now there's a reason to lean against the wind with monetary policy. So if you only have monetary policy, we want to lean against the wind. Okay? There's a stronger reason for intervening there. However, if you have macroprudential tools that are very perfect and very tailored, then again, you want to assign each goal to the right target. And in this case, macroprudential policy should take over the financial distortions, and monetary policy should go back to doing the usual prescription of inflation targeting. Okay. Now, the reason I have the two columns is, in practice, when the right-hand column is when you can target macroprudential policy perfectly. Okay. And you can think of the left column is when you don't have any macroprudential policy. Obviously, reality is somewhere in between, where maybe macroprudential policy is too coarse. Okay, and so I think perhaps a lesson, and this is a bit of a conjecture, is that we live somewhere in between these two, so that when we learn about this point here, it may still apply when we're trying to think of optimal system with macroprudential policy. Okay, this is an argument Jeremy Stein has made, that monetary policy fills all the gaps, basically, and macroprudential policy, because it can be avoided, or because macroprudential policy is always behind the curve relative to market participants, has that problem. Okay, so here's the new model, which is taking off of the kind of work by he and Krishnamurthy or Bruno Meyer-Sannikov. It's an asset pricing model. There's going to be uncertainty. And we're going to add to that, relative to those kind of asset pricing models, nominal rigidities, and think about optimal policy. So there's going to be incomplete markets. There's going to be a risky asset. It's a Lucas tree, just an endowment, and a risk-free short-term bond. And there's going to be two agents. We always need our Gen 80 to think about these things. There's going to be a saver that just wants to save in a risk-free asset, and a borrower that may borrow and invest in a risky asset. Okay. So you should think of there's a bunch of interpretations for these two categories. One would be, for example, the borrower is someone who invests in housing, okay? So that could be a household that invests in housing, a risky asset. Another interpretation is that the borrowers are hedge funds, okay, or other investment financial investors, okay? All right. So going back to a figure kind of like I had, but now more specific, let's think of these three periods. So in the first period, we are going to think about they're taking, the borrowing and investing decisions. And then in period one is where I'm going to have my recession, and I'm going to imagine the zero lower bound binds there. Okay, monetary policy is going to be somewhat constrained there. Okay, that's important. We want to think of always some constraint on monetary policy, or otherwise we should just, clean up after the fact. Okay, so a lot of our work is based on the idea that monetary policy won't be perfect. The easiest way to get that is to impose restrictions on monetary policy that we have seen, are realistic, obviously, in the last few years. But more generally, as long as we don't think monetary policy is the panacea, we're generally going to want to intervene in financial markets as well. So there's those two periods. Then there's the last period that's kind of a residual. It's just to introduce this asset that's risky. So the last period, it's actually in an endowment economy, and it's just where this Lucas tree pays off, okay? And to keep it simple, the asset can either be paying off a high dividend or a low dividend. There's two states of the world. And then there's these two types of agents, the savers and borrowers that I mentioned earlier, with fractions fee. If you like, think of fee as one half from now on. Okay, that's the model. Here's the equations for that description. Technology is going to be linear in labor, so we're going to produce output that's produced from labor, but I'm going to assume only the savers are workers, okay? Initially, we wrote the model, both savers and borrowers worked, but for our applications where we thought that the borrowers were bankers, that looked weird. So it's only the savers that work. And so this is total output, and then it just has to be, you know, equal to total consumption, which is just this sum here. Okay. And then that's true for period 0 and 1 because there's production there, but in the last period there's just an endowment, so the same has to be true, except on the right-hand side I just put the Lucas tree endowment. And then to complete the description of the model, I'm going to have these preferences, which is there's just going to be log in consumption, and they're actually in terms of consumption, they're equivalent between savers and borrowers. So I'm not putting in any, I'm not hardwiring any difference between savers and borrowers in preferences, except because I made savers the ones who work, there's this utility of work for savers but not for borrowers. Okay, and so they have the same utility function over consumption, the same discount factors. You'll notice I have these discount factors that have a subscript. That's just to ensure, you know, that I can be sure that at time one, the zero lower bound binds, okay? Because I can just make people very patient there, and it's a quick, easy way to ensure that.
Sorry, what is the difference between savers and borrowers?
For now, you can't see it. I'm getting to that next, okay? The key difference is going to be that borrowers can invest in the risky asset. They're specialists, okay? And can handle that risk, and the savers cannot, okay? But that's coming next, okay? So the other market assumptions are nominal rigidities. We'll just do that on the wage side, completely sticky, normalized to one, and that this zero lower bound binds at time one. Now to your question, Ben. So you see it in the budget constraints, basically. The savers have a budget constraint where they consume and decide how much to save for the future, and all these negative terms, if you throw them to the right, they're the resources they have at time zero. And that includes any initial endowment in bonds, the amount of labor income they get because they get paid a wage of one, and any taxes or transfers. Okay. In equilibrium, the amount they work is going to be determined, you know, by rationing in the labor market due to the nominal rigidities. Okay. In the next period, they have a similar problem. They're again just deciding how much to save and how much to consume. And in the final period, they just consume everything they have. Okay, but that's different from the borrowers because the borrowers have the same possibilities of consuming or saving in a risk-free bond, okay, except that they also can save in this risky asset. Okay, so X is how much they choose to hold of the Lucas tree, and here I'm doing X minus 1 over this. That's because they initially own the Lucas tree. So this difference is how much they're selling net, okay, at time 0. In equilibrium, that'll be zero because they're the only ones that can hold it, and they started holding it, so they will not be selling nor buying it. Okay, but this is the budget constraint they face, and you know that this describes their problem and helps determine equilibrium prices. Okay, so that's the key distinction, and the same happens, you know, in period one. Again, they could get rid of some of their Lucas tree. They won't in equilibrium. This will be zero in equilibrium, but they think they can. So that affects what this asset price has to be. They can also save and borrow in the risk-free asset. Okay, and in the final period, they consume this much. One more thing here. Note the tau. That's my macroprudential tax on borrowing. Okay, so that's going to create a wedge between this saving and this borrowing, and that's, you know, one of the main things I want to study. Just how big do we want that macroprudential tax? Okay, all right. The other variable I'll be interested in is R0, which appears everywhere here. Okay? And I'm not going to be interested in R1 because I'm going to think I'm at the zero lower bound where that cannot be moved. Okay? But with the budget constraint, we see all our assumptions finally and the tools that I'm talking about. Okay? So again, like I did before in the general case, let's just define the wedge. In this case, it's just the labor wedge. And I'm going to label that mu here. which is just with log utility, this is the MRS, and so this is a measure of how far we are from the first best. Okay. So if we had zero wedges, we would say we've achieved macro stability. Okay. We have neither a recession nor a boom, but if we have a positive wedge, we have a recession. Okay. Okay. So so now a very quick positive analysis. It's not too difficult. So financial market clearing requires the average bond. The bonds are in zero net supply, and the asset holdings of the risky asset should be equal to one. The demand should be equal to one because that's supply. With log utility, you know that consumption of savers is just going to be a fraction of the total wealth they have in period one, which includes the bonds they've brought in from the previous period and their labor income. Okay, so I'm showing consumption in period one. We'll go back to period zero later. Okay, so in period one, I'm saying we would just going forward, they're not going to work tomorrow. So they have this amount of earnings today, and they have this wealth they've brought in from the previous period. Well, this is their total financial plus human wealth. They're just going to consume a fraction of it. That's a common, you know, result with log utility. Same thing for the borrowers. They do have this Lucas tree, but we know in equilibrium they're not going to buy or sell it. So conditional on not doing that, they also, for the risk-free rate, you should think they have something similar. The only difference is they do have the financial wealth here from the Lucas tree. Okay. Okay, but when you put these two together, if you add them up and you do that properly, you know, you see that this debt drops out. Okay. And that's where I've assumed something different than in our prior work or in much of the literature, which is these guys have the same preferences and the same marginal propensities to consume. That's why debt is dropping out here when I do the aggregation. Okay. So that's distinct from stories where we had borrowers who have a very high marginal propensity to consume and savers who have a low marginal propensity to consume. Okay. So debt dropped out. So you might be wondering, why is debt going to matter? And as you'll see next, it will, but through the asset price. So when we impose an equilibrium in period one, consumption should equal output. After solving this, you're going to see that output is determined in a way that's related to the value of the asset price, one for one. Okay, so this captures, there's this feedback between how wealthy people feel and total consumption and spending, and hence total output. Okay, so there's kind of this two-way feedback between the financial market, asset price, and output. So how does that, that's basically one step removed. We just need one more step to get to this normative conclusions of the paper. Okay, so the key idea is that price is going to be influenced by the level of debt that agents brought in to the period one, okay? So the idea is that at period zero, they made some borrowing and saving choice. In period one, we inherited that, but that inherited debt does affect the asset price, okay? So, and I'm just gonna say here and not prove it, that basically you can show that the value of the asset price is decreasing in the amount of debt. Okay, I'll give you two intuitions for that. One is that if you have higher debt, so if the borrowers have higher debt, it's the savers that have higher savings then the person who can invest in this asset price has greater debt, has greater leverage, and in some sense they have this lower risk-taking capacity, okay? So they are going to demand higher risk premia, which is another way of saying the asset price, since the interest rate's fixed, the asset price is going to have to be lower, okay? There's interest rates at the zero lower bound. And that, through this channel, I'm saying, is going to lower consumption. There's another intuition, which is, I think, equally valid, which is higher debt implies that going forward, just thinking about the risk-free asset now, there's a higher precautionary motive, okay? Because they will have this higher debt, so they're going to be closer to zero consumption intuitively, okay? And that's going to produce a higher precautionary motive, which intuitively we can think of as requiring a lower natural rate of interest. And since we cannot lower the interest rate, that's going to translate into lower consumption. Okay. Now I just want to make clear, risk is completely clear key here. So if the asset price paid a fixed amount without any uncertainty, then we would get none of this. Okay. Because we have Gorman aggregation, we have the same preferences. and redistributing the debt would not affect anything. It's crucial that we have risk aversion and we have risk. Okay, so we've built a model with intermediation where the incompleteness of markets is crucial. Okay, right, and the incompleteness of markets comes here in the form that there's not enough assets, but also this assumption that there's some agents that are specialized in the risky asset, okay, and the other ones cannot. So there's imperfect risk sharing. Okay. Okay. Now to results. So since this allocation is completely pinned down by this level of debt, and I've given you some intuition which way it goes, the following results are going to be intuitive. There's going to be some value that we're going to get exposed for any given level of debt we come into period one with, okay? We can compute the entire allocation, we can compute utility, so there'll be some value function for the savers and some value function for the borrowers that only depends on that state variable. And imagine we're a planner that maximized some weighted sum of those utilities, okay? So with Pareto weights lambda, okay? Then I'm gonna jump to this idea that, you know, what's gonna matter is the marginal rate of substitution of this planner readjusting debt, taking into consideration the general equilibrium effects, comparing that to the ratio of marginal utilities that private agents experience in changing their level of debt. Okay, so let me say what that is. So let's look at this ratio of marginal utility of savers relative to borrowers adjusted for the Pareto weights, etc. That's equal to something standard. This is just the ratio of marginal utilities, okay, also adjusted by the Pareto weights, okay? But I have this fraction here that's in general not one, okay? So if this entire parenthesis were one, so this term were zero, then this represents the ratio of the private marginal rates of substitution, okay? One way to think about it is this is just by the envelope condition. This is just, if I think I have more debt in the next period, I evaluate it my marginal utility. And so you get that ratio of marginal utilities. Okay, so private agents are thinking of their marginal utility. They're not taking into account any general equilibrium effects. Okay, the extra term the planner has to do with the general equilibrium effects. Okay, so what does it say? It says that if there's a wedge in the labor market tomorrow, so if mu one is positive, then we would like to increase output. Okay, and so what we multiply that is by how output is affected by having more debt. And we saw earlier that relationship is negative. More debt is going to depress output. Okay, so that's going to lower this fraction, and that's going to be the source of, you know, the need for that macroprudential tax. Okay. All right, so I'm kind of anticipating where I'm going, but basically this ratio of the social marginal rate of substitution to the private one is the source of the externalities, okay? So now I'm gonna fill in that table, and it's gonna go a little faster. We have everything, all the elements there. Just to make things simple, I'll focus on Pareto weights that, you know, we don't have to worry about redistribution. So that's these Pareto weights, to get those out of the picture. And so the first box I had in my table that I wanted to fill in is, what if we don't have macroprudential policy and we have full rationality, okay? Rational expectation. So then what we want to figure out is what we should do with monetary policy. And the way I'm going to express that is show you what labor wedge do we want to have in period zero, okay? So kind of the canonical result is we should always have a zero labor wedge there because the zero lower bound doesn't bind, okay? But this result says, in general, you may want to depart from that, okay? And the idea is, if I have a labor wedge tomorrow, so if the labor wedge is positive tomorrow, let's say mu one is positive, this potentially then is non-zero, okay? And it depends on these other terms. Well, this is the familiar term I had earlier, okay? So let's imagine this is non-zero. But it's also multiplied by this term here, and that's capturing, well, what matters is I need to figure out how much debt I'm going to leave tomorrow. And the tool I have is the interest rate I control at time zero. And so what we care about is the product of this term, which we talked about earlier, and just how much, you know, debt is affected by the interest rate I set at time zero. Okay. And so the next point is we really need to know what this is, okay? And this numerator here, this term, we give an expression here. It's perhaps intuitive that you think that if I raise an interest rate, there will be less borrowing. But that's not true. There is income and substitution effects, okay? And this expression here shows that if, for example, initial wealth were zero for savers, then this response is actually zero. And that's because we're in the log case where the substitution and income effects cancel, okay? More generally, they don't cancel, but it's rather subtle which way this goes, okay? Okay, so I'm going to take that zero case as a baseline for that reason, okay? So summarizing, it may not be zero, but in some baseline cases it is, and it can take both signs, okay? So I'm filling that in as maybe if you want quotes around this, but inflation targeting pretty much, okay? This would be zero if this is zero, exactly. And that's what I would call inflation targeting. Well, this is a macro term, but basically, yeah, it's the usual criteria, and yeah. Okay, so I filled that in. Now the next ones will come. They just require one slide each. I'll show you next. The next one I'll show you is this one. Under full rationality, what would we do if we also had macroprudential policy? And here, it's very simple, actually. Basically, at time zero, the only reason I fiddled with the nominal interest rate and created an inefficiency in the first period was because I wanted to influence debt. But if I have a macroprudential tool, I can influence debt already, okay? So because of that, there's gonna be no role for monetary policy to not aim for a zero output gap in period zero, which I'll call inflation targeting. So we're going to get immediately this result. And instead now, the macroprudential policy is going to take care of that parenthesis I talked about earlier. Okay, and so the formula for tau is going to be very simple, and it's exactly related to the term I was talking about earlier. So that will generally be non-zero, okay? All right, so you're actually going to put a tax on borrowing to make the recession not as bad as it would be otherwise. Okay, that's the intuition. All right, so there's this kind of assignment of targets to instruments, if you like, macro stability with monetary policy, financial stability with macroprudential policy in this way, okay? Right, now let me go to the extrapolative expectations, and let's do the case with monetary policy only first. So I'm gonna model these extrapolative expectations assuming this equation for expectations, okay? So this is kind of in line with the work I cited earlier. So rho zero would be the case I studied earlier with rational expectations. If rho is zero, then the expectation people have is equal to the actual truth. Here, this is a model I wrote down with perfect foresight between periods zero and one. Okay, more generally, if we had uncertainty, we would want to impose rational expectations. Rational expectations with no shock between periods zero and one, it gives us perfect foresight. So rho zero is what I studied earlier. Now I'm going to allow rho positive. And what that does is it says, well, my expectation about future returns is increasing in the past returns. Okay? So for any given p minus one, the important thing is p zero is going to matter. Okay? A higher asset price today is going to make people get more optimistic. Okay? All right. And I'm monitoring my time and at 38 minutes. So that means I have 7 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Let me know otherwise. Okay, so this is an equation I want to be true because it's kind of in line with the assumptions, the type of equations people use in that financial literature. In our model, we can microfound that in two ways and it gives similar results. We can either play around with subjective probabilities about the high and the low dividend, and so that this is true, or we can directly throw in a wedge in the investor's Euler equation, okay? A little more mechanically. Both give the similar results. Okay, so let me try and go back to that ratio of marginal utilities I showed you earlier and say, yeah.
Savers and the bottom, they have the regular
Yeah, no, exactly. This is going to be, this is only going to be relevant. So I'll tell you what the planner does next, okay? The planner, we've done both things. This is a great question. The planner, we could study under the correct objective probabilities. That's our baseline, okay? Another thing you could do is say, no, let me maximize taking into account the expected utility with these extrapolative expectations. We've also done that, but we felt it's harder to justify. I mean, it sort of feels wrong that we would like people to get enthusiastic about, wrongly enthusiastic about their asset price because that makes them happy at time zero. But you could study both cases, and we've done that. But I'm going to focus on the case where the planner has objective beliefs. And the savers have the same beliefs as the borrowers. Yeah.
Does it matter that you know that this extrapolation is on the ratio of prices and not their levels? You can imagine that I don't think about returns, I just think about them.
Yeah, I think we're trying to do this more in line with the idea that it's returns that matter. But yeah, especially since I take P minus one is given, it's kind of the mechanism is really through the levels here. Except hold out because my last slide will say something different on that, I think. Okay, so this is the ratio as before, and now we get the same term here, this is the new term. And one can show, basically this has to do with the wrong expectation agents have about their future consumption. And this new term just reinforces the previous conclusions under the natural assumptions that the borrowers are becoming more optimistic, okay, and this will be the case in our equilibrium, okay. So it's just reinforcing the reasons for creating a disparity between the social and private marginal rates of substitution, okay. All right, that's kind of for intuition's sake. Now here's the result: if you have only the tool of monetary policy, what do you want to do with that nominal interest rate at time zero? This is what you want to do in terms of achieving, you're going to aim for this output gap. An output gap that is in general, again, not zero, because this right-hand side is not zero. The right-hand side looks a little hairy, bigger than before, okay? But again, it's really the same term we had before, augmented now again, okay? And the key thing I want to point out is before this numerator sometimes could be zero in some benchmark cases, and it was rather subtle. It was about income versus substitution effects. Now I want to emphasize that this term here is equal to this expression now. This is the subtle term I talked about earlier. Now there's a less subtle term that always goes in the direction, okay, that if you increase the interest rate, you will get less borrowing, okay? And the mech, and that's going to push to lean against the boom. So basically, we're going to want to have cool down the economy at time zero so that there's less borrowing, so that at time one, when we get the recession, it's not so bad. Okay? And the mechanism is pretty simple, I think, and intuitive. I think I have it here. You are, okay, that's a commonly used phrase, but let's go with a model. The basic idea is by cooling down the economy at time zero, you will lower the asset price at time zero. That will make agents less, experience a lower rate of return than otherwise. That's going to make them less extrapolative about that return going forward and borrow less. Okay, and since they will borrow less, things will be better at time one when the zero lower bound hits. Okay. So again, it's kind of taking seriously this extrapolation and thinking about the normative implications under conditions where monetary policy is not going to be able to do a perfect job, which I think is realistic. Okay. All right. So we filled that in. Yeah.
So in the finance literature, people also discuss the essential issue of extrapolate returns versus extrapolate cash flows.
So yeah.
Maybe a counterpart of extrapolate cash flows and what you do as well.
Yes. Yes. We've thought about that. I think Andrew prefers to think it's through dividends that this is happening, and our results go through that way. Okay, let me try and fill this in, this last one in, and it's very simple again. Now again, if this is the problem, we can just deal with the macroprudential policy. The macroprudential tax will be higher than before, Okay, but we don't need monetary policy to lean against the wind, because the only reason we were doing it was to indirectly get less borrowing. Okay, and if macroprudential tools can target that directly, we should just do it. Okay, now again, let's just remember that I do think we live somewhere in between these worlds, so maybe some of the lessons here will spill over when we do have macroprudential policy, but they're not perfectly targeted. Okay, let me end with an extension which is kind of fits outside this box, which is the following. I only considered extrapolative expectations at time zero, okay? And I imagined you had this Minsky moment that at time one you were perfectly rational, okay? But suppose we have extrapolative expectations at time one as well, okay? And adding that means it complicates the analysis. Now there are two things that I need from time one on to solve the model. I need to know the level of debt, but I also need to know the beliefs agents have, because they no longer had their Minsky moment where they turned rational. Instead, they did bring in some beliefs that's going to affect things. So there are two state variables. And in a nutshell, without going through it, let me just say, because there are two state variables, there isn't this perfect assignment anymore of tools to goals. And because of that, what we find is, in general, macroprudential policy is not enough. If you have extrapolation during the bust, then in general, you want to lean against the wind with monetary policy at time zero as well. And the intuition is, by leaning against the wind, what happens is when time one comes, the asset price falls, but it didn't fall from such a high place because we didn't have this super bubble boom earlier. So we don't become super pessimistic because, you know, asset returns were down 50%. They were down only 25% or something. And because of that, we're not so pessimistic going forward, and that helps the economy. Okay, so that's the intuition for why that matters. Also, so let me conclude then by saying, so the elements that we had here are monetary policy with or without macroprudential policy, and thinking about both macro and financial stability. And the results are that in some benchmark cases, you do want to align targets to these goals, a la Tinbergen, but in inflation targeting survives. But if macroprudential policies are either imperfect, or we have this this form of extrapolative expectations during the bust, then in general monetary policy faces a dilemma. Okay, and you want to go part ways and lean against the wind. Okay, I just want to emphasize again how key it was to have both uncertainty and a form of rational expectations that's not just you have the wrong expectations, but that they are endogenous and affected by the financial market, which we think is something worth exploring. Right, that's it. Thanks.